Welcome to A View of World Affairs from Greenwich. Politics, economy, history. A careful examination of the world's interrelationships and how they affect us, here in our country as well as here in Greenwich. And now here is your host, Fotis Baliakis.
Good morning, Greenwich listeners. This is Fotis Baliakis coming to you from AM 1490 WGCH in Greenwich. Welcome. Today is Saturday, 18th of March. Our subject is our geopolitical status from the perspective of our alliances. I believe that our alliances prove our strength and makes the difference to being a real hegemon versus the other up-and-coming powers or the more regional powers. So what we're going to do today is we're going to examine our relationships with other allies throughout the world, how they formed, how they have developed, how they're helping us with our geostrategic, geoeconomic, and also military alliances. So I'm going to remind you again what Thucydides said 2,500 years ago, because this is, again, very relevant. And I'm going to refer to a strong state and a weak state. And that changes. That is not always the same. Some states were weak, became stronger, like China, like Russia, and then they're reversed. So Thucydides said that the strong do what they can, while the weak struggle as they must. That is the moral that we will follow again. So the plan of the day is, how is the U.S. hegemony rest on the alliances, our security alliances, our economic alliances, diplomatic alliances, all of those that matter? We're going to talk about Europe and NATO. We're going to talk about Indo-Pacific, the AUKUS, the Five Eyes, the Quad, the Japanese bilateral, the South Korean bilateral. Now the Philippines bilateral agreements with Australia as well. Then we're going to talk about the relevance of those alliances and our strength in the war in Ukraine, because very obviously the war in Ukraine is a proxy fight between the East and the West, the liberal and the autocracy. So more about some other actors coming into play, like the BRICS. This expression, BRICS, was phrased by a Goldman Sachs economist in the early 2000s or mid-2000s, before the run-up to the financial crisis, where these countries, Brazil, India, Russia, China, South Africa, were up and coming with their economies gaining momentum. A lot of them had a lot of minerals. They had oil. They were exporting machines, and they had good populations to support their industries and their export manufacturing. So we will touch bases on that. But first, let's talk about how the U.S. got into those alliances. Why are they so important to us? We were involved in World War One, and we took a part of in the war as part of the alliance with France, the UK, Russia was an ally with us then. Italy was an ally with us then. Greece, Serbia. We fought the other side, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Germans, the Ottoman Empire. So mostly these countries had bilateral treaties and alliances between them, but not a comprehensive alliance as later were formulated. In World War II, we found ourselves to be in the same alliances, although some parties changed sides, such as, you know, the U.S. remained with the U.K., France, but now we got Poland, Czechoslovakia back then, Greece, Netherlands, and the USSR. Was an ally again against Germany, Japan, and now Italy. Italy had moved to the other side of the equation. So following World War II, and I'm going to refer to one of the papers that I wrote in December 2017 while I was at Columbia. It was the UN was formed in 1945, but very soon after, the US realized that although we are together in the UN Charter with Russia and they're a part of the Security Council, the UN Security Council, they were opposing now the liberal democracies and their development after the war, using their communist totalitarian system. So the U.S. in a cross-Atlantic diplomacy agreed to form in Washington, under the auspices of the U.S. as a leader, they agreed to form the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So this was basically the reason that the security in the daily lives of these countries in Europe, it was a peril because they were not sure how the follow-up of the war will develop. So it was a result, and it was based on and the Article 51 of the UN Charter that this political new body, NATO, which was a political body, was not just a military alliance, promotes democratic values and enables members to consult and cooperate with each other in defense, security issues, economic issues, and solve the problems by building trust between them and among them. And the ultimate reason for that is to avoid another conflict, another big conflict. But also, it had a military power to it because each of the members committed to a peaceful resolution of disputes, yet they were contributing military power in order to effect that change and to defend themselves. So it was not an alliance for aggression. It was an alliance for defense. And it has never aggressively taken over any sovereign state. It protected the states, the member states, but it from the opposite side, it may be viewed in a different way. So thus the security dilemma. So I'm going to refer now to this NATO as the liberal political alliance, not just the military defense alliance, and how Russia perceived that as a threat. And that is not a new thing that happened, you know, in 2008 when Ukraine and Georgia were proposed to be members, but it happened long time before. It happened in 1949, in 1952, in 1955, with a lot of the developments along the way. So it overlaps also the European Union, the European Community, which is clearly a political body, an economic alliance. So there are many members that are members of both. Obviously, you need to be in Europe to be that. So the U.S. And Canada are not members of the EU, but they're members of NATO. So this idea was that we as Americans, we like to promote democracy and quote unquote topple the regimes that they are non-democratic to go democratic so that they can eventually support the pro-Western, pro-US world order that we have established since the end of World War II. So some of the scholars have attributed this current situation in Ukraine to the zealotry that we have shown in the US and NATO to admit more and more of these countries that they were prior members of the Soviet Union. So, Mike McFaul, the professor at Stanford and a former ambassador to Russia, states that very clearly. You know, it was power politics, NATO expansion, and domestic politics that brought us here today. John Mearsheimer, University of Chicago political science, the science professor, he clearly states that in 2015 and 2022, that he continues to state that we, the West, is principally responsible for peeling off Ukraine from the Russian orbit and attaching it to the West. And that it was a red line and unacceptable to Russia. So, if we indulge me, I'm going to be reading some sections of this paper that reads as the NATO enlargement and Russia legacies since the collapse of USSR. It was written in December of 2017. I start with the question, is NATO's expansion since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 a calculated undermining of Russia's security status and a conspiracy to marginalize its current revival state? The answer is no. It was and still is a natural course of the balance of power in international relations and the result of the collective security of sovereign states. Furthermore, NATO's expansion is not the reason for Russia's recent adventurism, but rather a reflection of its desire to regain the luster of a bygone empire and the reestablishment of a bipolar world order to its favor. NATO was conceived immediately after the conclusion of World War II by 13 states which desired to create an organization that will provide military alliance which may eventually help to create political cohesion to avoid the catastrophic events of another world war. These states specifically sought collective security protection from the military threat of the Soviet Union and its authoritarian communist regime and political system. So I'm going to be pushing this idea that NATO is not just an alliance, but it's a political thought, a political movement, and it makes Russia very uncomfortable to be so close to its borders of these freedom-seeking liberal countries that make the Russians, not the regime, of Putin, but the Russians wonder, why not us? Why not me? Why do they enjoy all of that freedom and prosperity, and we don't? Why are we under the authoritarian regime of Putin or Yeltsin or anyone? So I'm going to be following with that, and you will see where that leads. Following World War II, it was clear that the victors were two blocs with drastically opposed ideologies, the West and the East. The West represented the liberal world order, where democratically elected regimes organized against and fought totalitarian regimes, and were interested to spread their principles. This is a key, interested to spread their principles, hoping that liberal states would respect each other and avoid wars. So by being history shows that democratic countries do not attack democratic countries. Totalitarian countries do attack democratic countries or another totalitarian country. So that is what history teaches us. On the other side, there was a communist regime that came to power in a bloody revolution following the conclusion of World War I. No sovereign state willingly lined up behind the Soviet Union's bloc, but the 13 countries of the West all shared the common values of freedom and liberty. According to NATO's records, there were never intentional policies for expansion, either at the beginning or following the eventual collapse of the Soviet Union. The alliances considered the request from countries that desired to share the collective defense doctrine, but also offered their military capability for the defense of the alliance as a whole, down to the individual member. The most significant and most debated addition to the group was that of West Germany in 1955, and later of East Germany, the portion that the Soviet Union occupied as part of the spoils of war Second World War. The individual countries without any assistance of, or prodding or coercion by the U.S. that held the most senior position willingly requested the membership. The U.S. provided the ultimate protection with the deterrence of its nuclear arsenal as the highest escalation of war. NATO, therefore, grew organically and after considerable debate at the beginning to directly counter the Soviet threat. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the new members sought the long-term stability offered by such a security regime. The Soviets and later Russia considered NATO their direct adversary, and rightly so, in their security dilemma thoughts. NATO, or North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was founded on April 4, 1949, between European states and North American states for the collective defense and security alliance of Europe following the devastation of World War II, to encourage European political integration, forbid the revival of nationalism and extremism, and to counter and deter the Soviet Union's expansion to Western Europe. In early 1948, the Soviets backed the overthrow of Czechoslovakia, democratically elected government then, and blocked Berlin as a result of West Germany's political consolidation. The U.S. undertook a monumental task of supplying food and other basic provisions to the East Berliners and permanently stationed U.S. troops there to deter the Soviets from overrunning the encircled city. Remember, it was a cross point called Charlie. It was defended by U.S., very few troops, but that was our tripwire for the cross point Charlie. The Truman administration under the Secretary of George Marshall devised a European recovery plan, which we're going to talk about later about how that helped Europe, known as the Marshall Plan, to assist Germany, Greece, and Italy, among others, to provide economic and political stabilization and rebuild their ravaged countries and economies, as well as to keep them from falling into the communist camp. In addition, the U.S. plan meant to bring the Europeans together to provide for a common defense from against the numerical superiority of the Soviet armies stationed in Central and Eastern Europe. Under that spirit, several countries came closer to cooperation on military, political, and economic integration. But it was not until the Soviet Union tested its first atomic bomb in 1949 to match the American nuclear weapon that the Allies were strongly motivated to conclude the treaty as a clear sign that Soviet danger was imminent, further reinforced by the outbreak of the Korean War, the first proxy war among the two adversary blocs. The original members of NATO were the USA, Canada, Belgium, Denmark, Iceland, France, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, and United Kingdom. The alliance created a political and military bureaucracy to integrate the variations of each country, with the Secretary General coming from the European countries and the military leadership from the U.S., which provided the majority of the forces and the nuclear deterrence. More specifically, the Articles of the Treaty encouraged the cooperation of its members, while the famous Article 5 spelled out the collective security commitment where an armed attack against one or more of them shall be considered an attack against them all. The article further prescribes that each ally would take such action as it deems necessary, including the use of armed force. Ironically, the only time this article was employed in practice was after the attack on the U.S. soil by Al-Qaeda on September 11, 2001. When Turkey was first proposed in 1950 for membership, was followed closely by Greece, the alliance became ambivalent. Some members considered the enlargement in the Balkans and the southeastern Europe as an act of aggression and a provocation to the Russians. So here come these thoughts and this discussion among the members. So we poke the bear. And what would that do? And how would we react? How would they react? But because the two adjoining countries had standing capable armies, that's critical, and occupied geostrategic land with access to the Black Sea, purely from the military defense perspective, they were granted membership in 1952 and all the protections that came from the military alliance. The U.S., along with the U.K., France, argued towards the expansion, where the central northern Europeans had a political and ideological concern that the prospective members lacked the uniformity of the European values. So we see now some social issues come into play, as well as what happened in 2008, where the Germans and the France resisted Georgia and Ukraine coming to the fold, where the U.S. and the U.K. were pro-expansion. This notion still continues to almost today. President Truman requested in March 1947 that the U.S. Congress special assistance to Greece to defeat the communist insurrection and for Turkey to resist Soviet pressure to join the Soviet bloc. This is the occasion where the U.S. president first declared the policy of containment, known as the Truman Doctrine, of checking the communist expansion. The U.S. considered the expansion not only as a military necessity, but as a political statement to rescue Greece and Turkey from the clutches of the Soviet communism. Greece was already the recipient of the Marshall Plan to rebuild the nearly destroyed country from the German, Italian, and Bulgarian occupation during World War II and the savage civil war that followed from 1946 to 1949. The Soviets and the brethren in the Yugoslavian Communist Party under General Tito supported the Greek communists in their insurrection and fueled the civil war. The conservatives were supported by the U.S. and the U.K. armed forces and ultimately defeated the communists and pushed them over the northern border to the Soviet bloc. Following World War II conferences in Tehran in 1943, in Yalta in 1945, Stalin agreed to, quote-unquote, free elections in Eastern Europe under the Soviet Constitution, and he considered the Balkans, including Greece, part of the same Soviet sphere of influence. A NATO expansion to the Balkans and Southeast Europe was, according to Stalin, contrary to the principal agreements the leaders made during the war. It seems also that the negotiations and the records are not clear as to the exact agreements amongst the leaders about the partition of the spheres of influence. And as a result, this first expansion will start a series of conflicts that lasted until the Soviet collapse in 91 and restarted in 2000 with the ascension of Vladimir Putin as the Russian Federation at the Russian Federation presidency. So this, again, is continuing today, the expansion. As a reaction to the NATO expansion, the first counter from the Soviets came early on by the invasion of the communist North Korea to the democratic South with the approval and military assistance by USSR. The NATO alliance, although not directly affected, and the U.S. were caught unprepared to respond. NATO's collective defense rested on the premise that it will resist the expansion of communists and will check the Soviet aggression using first and foremost a capable military and then a political organization to back its ideological liberal values. The Truman Doctrine called for response in the form of direct assistance to the South Koreans to stop the forceful spread of communism. Thus, the U.S., with allies Turkey and Greece and others, hastily assembled troops to fight the three-year war, which implicated communist China directly and ended in an armistice in 1953, that is still in effect today. The Korean War and the Chinese communist involvement sent waves of fears to the West and especially to the NATO allies. It was realized that the Central and Western European countries need additional military power that can only be provided with the inclusion of Germany. Here comes big issue, inclusion of Germany in NATO alliance. It took the allies 4 years to debate the admittance of its 15th member, the newly established 1949 Federal Republic of Germany. In 1955, it was admitted while it was still occupied by the allies. This further expansion caused a reaction in the Soviet side to create a counter to NATO alliance. The Warsaw Pact, consisting of the Soviet Union, Romania, Bulgaria, Albania, Czechoslovakia, the German Democratic Republic, which is East Germany, Hungary, and Poland. The Russians effectively created a physical buffer zone to the western border of their country to protect it from potential invasions, reminiscent to them of the Napoleonic Wars and the German Operation Barbarossa in World War II. In the same year, the Geneva talks between the Western allies and USSR resulted in the Détente arrangement of the status in Europe. Simultaneously, the now freed states from colonialism in Asia and Africa met in Indonesia to declare their dissatisfaction with the colonial countries and specifically to avoid being drawn into an expansion of NATO and into a conflict that we're unprepared to sustain. This period also produced the first effective arms control treaty with the establishment of Antarctica as a non-military zone and open for technical and scientific explorations by all countries. In the NATO summit of Paris in 1957, the Allies realized that Warsaw Pact's conventional army superiority in Eastern Europe and the threat of an invasion elevated U.S.'s nuclear deterrence of massive nuclear retaliation doctrine if the Soviets attacked with conventional warfare. The total nuclear escalation in case of attack by the Warsaw Pact was formulated in the first offset, and that is in capital O offset, which is a norm that I'm going to use later. And it became a theory, the first offset theory, and then the second and the third, and I will explain. It was a strategy purely using strategic nuclear weapons for a counter value targeting. Again, I repeat, counter value targeting, that is aiming at soft targets like cities, infrastructure, and population. This is exactly what Russia is doing right now, counter value targeting. The strategy eventually led to the realization of the mutually assured destruction theory, MAD, mutually assured destruction, where each side had enough offensive capability to destroy each other with the first strike and survive and counterstrike. Because that counterstrike hit their weapons, that they were not touched by the first strike. So the subsequent arms race for more weapons and more capable warheads and delivery systems was based now on a counter force targeting strategy, where the weapons from NATO and the US and the Warsaw Pact, Russia, were aimed at destroying the nuclear weapons triad of weapons, land, air, and sea, and making its side incapable of counterstriking. This strategy was based on the Carl von Clausewitz theory that the ultimate battle in a total war should result in destroying the adversary's ability to wage further war, and furthermore, taking away their willingness to fight, while realizing a victory short of reaching the MAD level, the mutual assured destruction. Under this protective umbrella, Europe started a remarkable recovery from 1950s that will last until 1970s in the oil embargo following the Middle East wars. The Détente will occasionally be interrupted by Soviet action in Berlin, the only site of direct contact of the two adversaries. Finally, the destruction of the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961 surprised the Allies that the Soviets will go to such an extent to avoid the defection of the citizens across the borders and to create a nuclear separation between the two. The status of an active but cold war had settled globally, pitting the Western liberals against the Eastern totalitarians. The status of Germany will reappear again in 1990 with a unification of the East and West following the collapse of the Soviet Union, which unification will create part of today's Russian negative attitude towards Western NATO's expansion. In the 1960s, relations with the Soviet bloc took a negative turn with the Cuban Missile Crisis and then the Vietnam conflict. Although NATO was not a participant in either event, its existence created a status quo in the European theater, which caused conflicts to shift and erupt in other parts of the globe, since the nuclear escalation was real and credible deterrent for the protection of Western Europe and Southeast Europe. Following the 1963 Cuban Missile Crisis, where Khrushchev and John Kennedy were faced with total nuclear war, it was realized that there would be an intermediate solution of limited war to separate conventional war from that of the total nuclear war. Fearing that further expansion of NATO will continue the cycle of reprisals from the Warsaw Pact, like today, the Europeans turned into creating and developing an economic and political integration, especially following the closure of the Suez Canal crisis in 1956. Additionally, both the US and European allies realized that the Soviets were advancing rapidly in technology, especially in the outer space, with the launching of the first satellite Sputnik and the first human to circle the Earth in space, Yuri Gagarin. The space game became another domain of competition, and an arms race was clearly underway. The French withdrew from Indochina, and the takeover of the conflict by the Americans to further the doctrine of containment focused the Cold War conflict in Southeast Asia, where all three powers, China, Russia, and U.S., were directly or indirectly involved. While the U.S. paid attention to a non-NATO region in Asia, the Allies and U.S. devised a new doctrine, calling it the second offset, to retain a technological edge of weaponry and force deployments to the Soviet preponderance of the means of a conventional war. This strategy involved the use of nuclear tactical weapons. The strategy involved the use of nuclear tactical weapons, miniaturized versions of the nuclear weapons of mass destruction. So this was our American idea of how to do that, because we were not there in force. The Europeans were thought they are in force. Our attention was somewhere else. Now we need to counter that offset. So we made small weapons that we actually gave to Green Berets, and they moved them around in their backpack, and they were able to, or they should have been able to deploy in, because the Soviets were having mass concentrations of armed vehicles and tanks and concentrations of troops. So these weapons became very local and very effective. So the use of the weapons will have acted as a force multiplier, since the U.S. was occupied in another war far away from the theater. NATO faced with finite conventional armies, the ever-present threat of invasion, and the U.S. embroiled in conflicts, concentrated in an economic and political development to counter the singularly minded Soviet Union in its quest for military domination, while its demand economy was narrowly focused towards the support of the military domination. So this is the critical difference. Our economies, our free economies, they produce, but not necessarily for the war machine, where the Soviet economy was purely focused on that without any concern for their, for the well-being of their citizens. And that was their demise. Following the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, there were not significant conflicts that involved NATO. The Middle East wars in 56, 67, 73 were significant to the balance of power in the Middle East and were more of a proxy war and a direct conflict with the U.S. and Russia without the involvement of other NATO countries. The only significant change is the admission of Spain as a 16th member in 1982. The substantial and very consequential changes to the détente will come after the unsuccessful Russian invasion and occupation of Afghanistan from 1979 to 1989, to support a communist puppet government against the will of its tribal population. This massive effort weakened the Russian state and exposed the social, political, and mostly economic fissures compared to the Western liberal order. With the ascension of Mikhail Gorbachev as the Secretary General, he inadvertently released the bottled up human desire for freedom and liberty of the Russian people with glasnost and perestroika. And in my view, this is what I think Putin is afraid right now. Not the armies, but the freedom and the democracy. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was a seismic change to the détente and the relations between East and West. Now Germans finally can be reunited. The West won the ideological, economic, and military contest we came to recognize as the Cold War, a bipolar world order that is no longer there. The July 1990 German unification of East and West states was natural to close the end of World War II, but had significant implications to the status of forces in Europe and the future relations with Russia. Was it a state unification or a NATO expansion? During the September 1990 final settlement with respect to Germany, the 2+4 treaty, which is among the two German states, US, UK, France, and USSR, there was no commitment from allies to abstain from NATO enlargement towards the Russian buffer zone and what they considered the countries in their sphere of influence. The agreement was specific that upon removal of the Soviet armies in East Germany, They will be replaced by West German units assigned to NATO without the addition of non-German forces or nuclear weapons. The weakened Soviet states negotiated this peaceful and remarkable transformation in the international order since the end of World War II. The spoils belong to the victor. The West took advantage of its current strength, an accomplishment to make a substantial difference to a peaceful coexistence. Remember Thucydides. Since the 2014 Crimea annexation, the political explanation from the Russian side by Putin, Medvedev, or Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov refers to a broken promise narrative that dates back to pre-World War I Imperial Russia, and as recent as the German unification and the 2008 Bucharest summit, NATO Bucharest summit. In 1908, Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs Alexander Izlovsky, hoping to assure Russian access through the Straits of Bosporus and the Dardanelles, then controlled by the Ottomans and supervised by the British, sought to make a trade towards that end, opposing the access with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who competed with Russia in the Balkans. Izlovsky proposed that Austria could annex Bosnia and Herzegovina in return to UK's favor to accept the access to an ally that most recently had assigned a convention of cooperation. Unfortunately for the Russians, the British did not accept the opening of the Straits, fearing Russia competition, and the Austrians had moved already to announce the annexation. So these quote-unquote betrayal and humiliation became a crisis in Moscow and an argument for future claims to this day. While the negotiations were going for the unification of Germany after the fall of Berlin Wall, no one could imagine that within a year there would be bigger and irreversible changes to the balance of power. When perestroika and glasnost started to show the signs of strain in the Soviet system, individual countries were encouraged to seek their own freedom from the bloc. As the Soviet Union, as the then Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze later said, the idea of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact dissolving and NATO taking into the former pact members was beyond imagination. This was a paradigm shift, and it was unexpected, and therefore no one planned any strategy to address it. The newly freed countries after 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union immediately considered their sovereign rights and the potential path to security, freedom, and growth. The 1975 Helsinki Charter for a state to choose its alliances gave them the pretext to consider their options. Since they were all in European continent, it was only natural to seek first and foremost protection of their sovereign borders. NATO and the newly formed European Union were their only options. NATO could have ignored the request, but it took NATO 3 years just to start the debate of the enlargement, fearing the security impact on Russia, which had reformed to a new state without many of its satellite countries. In 1994, the Partnership for Peace and the 1997 NATO-Russia Founding Act established the Permanent Joint Council as an open forum of discourse between the parties for cooperation and peaceful integration of potentially new states in the alliance. The act, therefore, made it clear that NATO was not interested in installing substantial conventional forces or any nuclear weapons in the territories of the new member states from the old Warsaw Pact. But the essence of the discussions was not to avoid the consideration of the admittance of the Central and Eastern European countries to NATO, but to assist Russia to integrate herself in the new world order of pan-European security and economic cooperation. There may have been a case where the U.S. diplomats made promises to restrain the expansion eastwards. We wouldn't know. There is not enough written record anyway. The controversy of the parts of the losing side wanting to join the bloc of the winners is unavoidable. But the Russians, a weakened state and a wounded national pride, all appear to be an encirclement while they were still down for the count. Russia could not have exerted any pressure to the individual countries acting on their own best interest and had no negotiation leverages against NATO to change the terms or deny them access. It became a damage control issue, and later Yeltsin was blamed for accepting de facto the NATO actions. In 1999, finally, NATO accepted the Czech Republic after it separated from Slovakia including Poland and Hungary. On the same year, NATO's military intervention in Kosovo against the Serbians was viewed by Moscow as an insult to injury. It took like a significant geopolitical liberal intervention in an internal conflict of a sovereign state for assumed humanitarian reasons. But the Russians lacked the veto power in the Security Council to counter it. The US and NATO were furthering their plans to install anti-missile defense systems aimed to protect the alliance from states like North Korea and Iran. But the message is Moscow was that they were intended to marginalize Russian nuclear deterrence. Furthermore, the active NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and democracy experts being overly active in Russia and the surrounding countries became a serious problem for the reactionary autocrats and oligarchs. The color revolutions in Georgia, Ukraine brought a new government with Eastern ideology, and they were even considering joining the European Union or the NATO alliance or both. These steps became increasingly unacceptable to the Kremlin as the broken promise mentality was growing assertive as a foreign policy. In his speech following the Crimea annexation, President Putin admits that Gorbachev's plans aided in the collapse of the Soviet Union, and what seemed impossible became a reality. Putin complained of NATO's and US's duplicity about Kosovo intervention and the way the West viewed Russia's intervention in the Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea, not in similar light as their own actions in Kosovo. He mentioned that the loss of bipolarity meant instability and abuse, and that the international institutions are degrading. Putin complained that the US has acted unilaterally and forced the rules by the threat of the gun, ignoring or bypassing UN assembly. He mentioned the interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. He believes that Russia intervention in Crimea was justified in far superior way than any all the other US-NATO actions he listed, but he infers that these actions are happening against Russia and Ukraine to avoid a Eurasian integration. He also mentions the historical lies and decisions made by the West without consultation with Russia and despite its disapproval, like the missile defense system and the military units near the Russian border. In a similar fashion that China was treated as an ascending power in the world order, Russia was given the opportunity to join the international institutions that were set up by liberal world order following World War II. In 2002, Russia was admitted to the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the G7. The Western world was allowing Russia a seat at the table to restore their prestige and to receive their contributions to the world order. But Putin, in his speech, complains that the West is applying financial sanctions to retard the growth and hurt the economy. Very tellingly, he states, in short, we have every reason to assume that the infamous policy of containment led in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries continues today. And in Western Ukraine, our Western partners have crossed the line, playing the bear and acting irresponsibly and unprofessionally. So it is obviously that the next NATO expansion is just an excuse for an aggressive behavior. The Russian anger has boiled over, and Ukraine was the red line that was meant to be held. So without going any further into what we already know, what happened in Russia, the picture is that Russia was hurt long, long time ago. It wasn't just in 2004 to 14 with what they called a civil war in Ukraine, but Ukraine became the red line that they didn't want anyone to cross, and they gave us a heads up in Georgia. So now, if we switch to where we are now in the war, and then I'm going to talk about some other alliances, the Ukrainian war is a proxy fight for the maintenance of the current world order. The stalemate in Ukraine is that neither side is willing to compromise right now to bring the other side to stop fighting. Ukraine's plan to progress to push Russian forces out depends on the Western material support and economic sanctions on Moscow, while the Russian military resources decline from the combination of attrition and sanctions. Plus, we don't know what China will do as they step in, or they say they will step in. So what I think will happen, cyber war maybe have been used. If it was used, it was blunted. Therefore, it became a no issue. The satellites, we both have satellites, US, China, Russia. They have not played a role yet other than our satellites giving images and target direction to the Ukrainians. But no one has attacked our satellites. We have not touched their satellites. So that domain remains untouched. Belarus, not active, not involved unless they threaten, unless they are attacked. But they're very weak, very small army, very weak, weaker than the Russians. The oil gas shutoff, I think that will happen. There are pipelines still running through Ukraine, going to Europe. The Russians, at some point, they will have to shut those off because that provides them income, but also the Ukrainians income as well. Now, before tactical nukes are used, and I know John, John Sidlidis, my guest last time, said that Russians may use them, not in concentration of forces, but out there so that they can show that they have them and they can exist. I think more practical things can happen, like gas poisoning. You know, if you remember Syria, those kind of things that are very local. They can happen in smaller scale. So it's not the end of the world. We're not using nuclear weapons. So that kind of action is very potential. Misinformation, disinformation, it will happen, it's happening, it will continue to happen. Other proxy fights where we can now find ourselves toe-to-toe with the Russians. You remember in 2018, we annihilated a combat unit of Russians and the Wagner Group that attacked a small special forces and Marines in Syria. They were totally annihilated. They were not even a match for our troops. So if we go toe-to-toe, history says that we have the upper hand if it happens in a proxy fight somewhere else, like Syria or Libya. In the high seas, we can play the cat and mouse chase with the submarines. It's happening. We don't know, but it hasn't shown up yet. But they did fly bombers over the Alaska. We knew that before. Nothing happened there. They were just poking. What Russia wants now, this is to be a frozen conflict. Nothing to happen. And they're just breaking the country apart. So now we're going to get a bucket of nuts and bolts and we need to put it together. So he will lose his political strength. Just remember that the Tsar Nicholas II, the last Tsar, it took him almost 2.5 years or under 2 years to lose his power as he was losing the war in World War I. So the Wagner Group is there. It has political power, although it is under Putin, but it is capable. It has arms. It's a unit. It's established. Who knows what can happen? Who knows if someone can switch them and flip them over? And the Kadyrov, the other chieftain in the Caucasus, maybe he will switch. Maybe these two will combine together. So all of that goes around. The decisive battlefield will be in the U.S. In March 22, the resolution in support of Ukraine passed both houses unanimously. But ever since has been falling off, has been losing from both parties. So the air support, I don't know if they're gonna get it now anytime soon to have an effect. Everybody, the U.S., U.K., France are saying that they're gonna have it after the war. Well, that would be useless after the war for their security. But I just don't see that happening anytime soon. Looking at what has happened to the discussion about the tanks, which now are arriving, hopefully for the spring, and that will have an effect. The sanctions will continue. And the big question now is the Marshall Plan. How we're talking about an estimate of $750 billion for the reconstruction of Ukraine. George Marshall gave an 11-minute speech at Harvard when Truman established the plan, the Marshall Plan, the reconstruction plan that I mentioned before in Europe. That is what needs to happen right now. I don't hear a lot of the talk right now from the Europeans. It needs to happen from Europe and obviously from the US, but that number is huge and it will get bigger. And the question about Germany. Germany will change. Germany is losing its industrial base. Depends on China for the trade. Will that continue? I doubt it. Will they switch to nuclear power? They should. I don't know how fast that political change will happen because it's purely political. And they will continue to depend on the U.S. for their nuclear umbrella. Other alliances, the most important of all right now, or top of the importance scale, is Japan, our Japanese alliance, bilateral alliance. Then South Korea. We have given them both an umbrella alliance with nuclear weapons. Now we're integrating a little more, the Quad. It's called the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, U.S., India, Japan, and Australia. I don't know why Korea is missing, but I think the issue is South Korea and Japan are getting closer and closer and closing this gap that was created by the Japanese aggression in World War II. So that is a key. That Quad has its roots in the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake that brought this regional core group together. But it has now evolved to something bigger. There's now a fear of China, and the military and economic cooperation that is bringing this together. And that is critical, because India is a neutral party, more or less, but now is in our midst. And it's, in this case, they're committed and their military benefits from it, and they are participating vigorously in it. Australia is coming up hugely as one of our biggest allies. And now we have another agreement with them in the UK, where the AUKUS agreement, the initials of its country, where we will sell them the technology for 5 nuclear attack submarines, because that's what they need to prowl and secure the vast Pacific Ocean so near to the China and hold them all into the first row of islands around China. That is a critical. Alliance that we need to maintain and give them more of our secrets. And this is the secret. I mean, this is the weapon, the secret. Everybody can see a nuclear powered aircraft carrier. You don't see those nuclear powered submarines. They're not going to carry nuclear weapons, but they will be powered, which is hugely important for the longevity of their patrols in the oceans. The next one is the Five Eyes. The Five Eyes is a alliance of Canada, U.S., Australia, New Zealand. I'm missing one, where we share intelligence information, and that is critical in the theater. And that is bringing our alliances together. Our strength lies with our alliances, and that is our strength that China does not have. China still threatens their neighbors. They're not in alliance with their neighbors. We also have now the Philippines coming back with the son of Marco, giving us access to multiple locations within access to the South China Sea, where the Chinese have militarized a lot of islands. So this is a critical part of our strength. We need to continue. We need to keep them close, and we need to support our allies in their fight, in their economic survival, and in their economic prosperity. Thank you for listening to me. Have a great Saturday. Hope to see you next week.